Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We sift through the sources so you get the essentials. Today, we're tackling something really fundamental, maybe a bit grim, but governed entirely by physics.
Yeah.
How injuries actually happen to the human body. And, you know, when you look at the numbers, it's kind of staggering. Trauma, things like car crashes, falls, accidents. It's the number one killer and cause of disability for people aged, 1 to 44. It's a massive issue. So our mission today is to really get into the science, the kinetics, the biomechanics, to understand why specific forces lead to specific, often predictable, injuries inside the body.
And that predictability, that's absolutely crucial for responders arriving on scene. But simply, trauma happens when some kind of external energy hits the body and it's just too much for the body to handle, to absorb, or dissipate.
Okay, external energy, that sounds pretty broad. Are we just talking about like getting hit by something, or is it more?
Oh, much more. We often think of mechanical energy, you know, the impact itself. But you can also have injuries from chemical energy, think corrosives or thermal energy burns. Then there's electrical energy and even barometric energy, which you see with things like explosions. The physics behind each type determines the damage.
Right. So let's dig into the physics of impact first. You mentioned biomechanics and kinetics. How do those apply for, say, emergency crews?
Well, biomechanics is the broader study, like how our bodies move, the mechanics of living tissue. Kinetics gets more specific. It's the study of the forces themselves, speed, mass, direction, and how they directly cause injury.
And this all comes down to basic physics, right? Newton's laws.
Pretty much, especially the second law. Force equals mass times acceleration, or in the case of an accident, deceleration. The faster something stops, the greater the force.
But the really critical concept, the one that dictates just how bad an injury might be, that's kinetic energy, isn't it?
That's the big one, absolutely. The formula itself tells the story. Kinetic energy equals mass divided by 2 times velocity squared.
That velocity squared part, the V squared, that's the real kicker, the thing that turns a minor bump into something devastating.
Precisely. It is the most critical factor we look at. Think about it. If you double the mass, say a bigger truck hitting something instead of a car, you double the energy. Okay, that's significant. But if you double the velocity, say going from 30 miles per hour to 60, you don't just double the energy, you quadruple it. It increases exponentially with speed.
Wow, okay. So even a small speed increase means a massive jump in the force the body has to somehow deal with, usually in just milliseconds. That's where we get those high G forces, right?
Yep.
Multiples of gravity's pull.
Exactly. And how the body deals with that energy transfer determines the injury. The duration of the impact matters, the direction, the angle, but also, fundamentally, the type of body tissue involved.
That's interesting. So our own internal makeup plays a big role in what gets damaged.
Definitely. Consider organs filled with gas, like our lungs. Gas compresses easily, right? So lungs are very susceptible to crushing forces and an impact. But organs filled with liquid, like the liver or spleen, they don't compress easily. Liquid resists compression. So instead, they're more vulnerable to tearing forces or shearing when everything around them stops suddenly, but they keep moving. That difference is key to predicting internal injuries.
That makes sense. And it leads us perfectly into the classic example everyone thinks of, the car crash.
Yeah.
A motor vehicle crash, or MVC. Our sources say it's not just one impact, but like a sequence of events, 5 phases.
Yeah, think of it like a super fast chain reaction. Phase one, the vehicle itself decelerates, the metal crumples, the car stops.
Right.
Phase two,
the
person inside decelerates. They hit the steering wheel, the dashboard, the seatbelt locks, the airbag goes off, their body stops.
Okay, so car stops, person stops.
Right.
But it's not over.
Not internally. That's phase three, the deceleration of the internal organs.
Uh-huh.
Even when your torso stops, your organs inside, liver, spleen, heart, brain, they're still moving forward because of inertia. Until they smash into the inside of your body cavity or the tissues holding them in place stretch and tear. That's how you get things like a torn aorta or lacerated liver in a high-speed crash. It's the internal collision.
That's, yeah, quite a visual. And there are 2 more phases. What else is going on?
Phase 4 is secondary collisions. Think about loose stuff in the car. Your phone, a toolbox, groceries, whatever. When the car stops suddenly, those things become projectiles and can hit the occupants.
Oof, yeah. Haven't thought of that.
And phase 5 is any additional impacts. Maybe the car spins out after the first hit and smacks a guardrail or gets hit by another vehicle. It all adds to the forces involved.
Okay, let's look at specific crash types. Frontal collisions, head on, that's the classic deceleration injury scenario. What happens to someone not wearing a seatbelt?
We typically see 2 pathways. There's the down and under path. The person slides down in their seat, knees hit the dash first. That force travels up the femurs to the hips, potentially fracturing them, and the chest might hit the steering wheel.
And the other way.
The up and over. The body pivots upwards over the steering wheel or dashboard. This leads to really bad head and neck injuries, plus potential crush injuries to the chest and abdomen from hitting the top of the wheel or dash.
It really underscores how vital seatbelts are. Even if they leave a bruise, they control that second phase, stopping you from taking those pathways.
Exactly. Seatbelts manage that occupant deceleration, keep you in the seat, prevent ejection, which is often fatal. Yes, you can get neck sprains or bruising, but it's far better than the alternative. And airbags, especially for frontal crashes, they have cut deaths by about 30%. They provide a cushion, a more controlled stop, though, you know, sometimes the bag itself can cause minor burns or injuries from the deployment force or chemicals.
Now, what about side impacts?
Yeah.
Getting T-boned. The physics must be totally different. Seatbelts don't seem like they'd help as much there.
They offer much less protection in a lateral crash, unfortunately. The force comes directly into the side of the car, pushing the occupant sideways. The body absorbs that energy directly into the shoulder, chest wall, pelvis on that side. And the head often whips sideways towards the impact, leading to serious neck injuries, plus injuries to the ribs, maybe the spleen or liver on the impacted side.
Okay, let's step outside the vehicle context for a minute.
Oh, sure.
Pedestrian injuries. Is there a similar sequence there?
Yes. Usually a three-impact sequence helps predict the injuries. First, impact. The car's bumper hits the body, usually the legs or pelvis in adults.
Okay.
Second impact. The person's body is thrown up onto the hood or grill of the car. This is often where chest, abdomen, or head injuries occur. Third impact. The body is thrown off the vehicle and hits the ground or maybe another object.
And you mentioned something specific for kids. The Waddell triad.
Right. For children or shorter adults, because of their height relative to the car bumper and hood, we often see a predictable pattern called the Waddell triad. Injuries to the femur on the side of impact, chest, or abdominal injuries, and a head injury on the opposite side as they're thrown. Knowing that pattern helps responders look for those specific injuries.
A fall from height. What determines how bad that is, besides just how high?
Height is obviously key, but several other things matter a lot. How did they land? Feet first, head first, flat on their back, what part of the body hit first.
Makes sense.
Also, what did they land on? Concrete is obviously much worse than grass or softer ground. And finally, the person's physical condition, age, bone density, overall health affects how well their body tolerates the impact. It all influences how that kinetic energy turns into damage.
Okay, so blunt trauma is about widespread force.
Mm-hmm.
Let's shift gears to penetrating trauma, where the energy is super focused. Like stab wounds or gunshots. Firearms are the big one in the U.S., right?
They are. With stab wounds, it's usually lower velocity. The damage is mostly limited to the tissues directly cut or crushed by the blade. The severity depends on, you know, where the wound is, how deep it went, the angle, the length of the blade.
But gunshots. That brings us back to velocity, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Gunshot wounds are all about velocity, that kinetic energy formula again. A bullet, especially from a rifle, travels at incredibly high speed.
So even a small bullet can do massive damage if it's fast enough.
Precisely. That high velocity transfers a huge amount of energy to the tissues. It creates the permanent cavity, the actual hole the bullet makes by destroying tissue. But maybe more importantly, it creates a massive temporary cavity around that path.
Temporary cavity.
Yeah, the tissue stretches and snaps back violently due to the shockwave passing through. This stretching and tearing can damage blood vessels, nerves, and organs far from the bullet's actual path. And denser tissues, like muscle or liver, absorb more energy and have wider temporary cavitation than less dense tissues like the lungs.
Okay, that explains a lot. Now, what about the most complex type blast injuries? From explosions, you said that involves barometric pressure.
Right. Explosions create intense pressure waves. And blast injuries are really complex, often causing multiple injury types at once. We usually categorize them into five types.
Five. Okay, what's the first?
Primary blast injuries. This is damage caused directly by the pressure wave itself hitting the body. That sudden change in pressure can literally rupture organs.
And you mentioned air-filled organs are most vulnerable again.
Exactly. Lungs are very susceptible to blast lung injury. Eardrums often rupture. The gut can be injured too. Being close to the explosion source means a high risk of death just from this primary shock wave.
Okay, primary is the pressure wave. What's secondary?
Secondary injuries are what people usually picture. Injuries from flying debris, shrapnel. These cause both penetrating wounds, like being hit by fragments, and blunt trauma from larger objects thrown by the blast.
Makes sense. Tertiary.
Tertiary injuries happen when the blast wind physically throws the person against something solid, a wall, the ground, a vehicle. This causes injuries similar to falls or being ejected from a car, fractures, head injuries, internal bleeding, sometimes called ground shark if they hit the ground hard.
All right, primary, secondary, tertiary. What are the last two? Quaternary and quinary.
Quaternary is kind of a miscellaneous category. It includes things like burns from the heat of the blast, breathing problems from dust or toxic fumes, crush injuries if a building collapses on someone, or injuries from being trapped.
And quinary, that sounds unusual.
Quinary injuries are specific to contaminants added to the bomb. Think dirty bombs. These injuries are caused by exposure to biological agents, chemicals, or radiation packed with the explosive. It adds a whole other layer of hazard.
Gotcha. And you mentioned something about closed spaces making explosions worse.
Hugely worse. In a confined space, that primary pressure wave reflects off walls, reinforcing itself, making it much more powerful. Plus, any toxic gases or smoke produced gets concentrated, increasing the risk of respiratory injury, which falls under quaternary.
And the ear is the most sensitive part.
Yes. The ear, specifically the eardrum, is often cited as the most sensitive organ to those rapid pressure changes. A ruptured eardrum can be an early indicator that someone experienced a significant blast wave, even if other injuries aren't immediately obvious.
Okay, so we've covered how these injuries happen. Let's shift to the response.
Yeah.
When someone has multiple injuries, multi-system trauma, what's the approach?
The core philosophy is fast assessment, treating the biggest threats first and getting them to the right hospital quickly. It's all about prioritization and speed.
And that assessment follows a specific pattern. I think I've heard of ABCs.
It's actually evolved slightly. We now often use XABCDE. The X stands for exsanguinating hemorrhage, massive external bleeding. You have to stop that first, even before airway, because you can bleed to death in minutes.
Right. Stop the bleed, then the rest.
Then you manage the airway, ensure breathing is adequate, check circulation, pulse, skin color, internal bleeding signs. Assess disability, their neurological status like alertness, and finally expose the patient fully to look for hidden injuries and manage their environment, like keeping them warm. You fix life threats as you find them in that order.
And time is absolutely critical. You mentioned the platinum 10 minutes.
That's the goal for the most critical patients. Ideally, limit on-scene time to 10 minutes or less. That means doing only the absolute essential life-saving steps, controlling major bleeding, basic airway maneuvers, maybe sealing a sucking chest wound and then getting moving towards the hospital. Definitive care happens there.
When responders see a patient is really circling the drain, they look for something called the trauma lethal triad. What is that?
Ah, yes. The lethal triad is a terrible combination of three things. Hypothermia, where the body temperature drops too low. Coagulopathy, where the blood stops clotting properly. And acidosis, where the blood becomes too acidic because of poor circulation and shock.
How do they connect?
They create a vicious cycle. Being cold makes it harder to clot. Not clotting means more bleeding, which worsens shock and leads to acidosis. Acidosis and shock make it harder for the body to stay warm and clot. It just spirals downwards. Seeing signs of this triad means the patient is in profound shock and needs aggressive resuscitation at the hospital.
So getting them to the right hospital is key. How do they decide whether to go to the nearest hospital or bypass it for a specialized trauma center? What are the big red flags?
There are clear criteria. Physiologically, if their vital signs show serious compromise, like an altered mental state, maybe a GCS score of 13 or less. Glasgow Coma Scale, basically how awake and responsive they are. Or if their systolic blood pressure is below 90, indicating shock. Or if their breathing is too fast or too slow, outside that 10-29 breaths per minute range for adults, any of those warrant a trauma center.
What about the injuries themselves, even if the vitals seem okay initially?
Yes, anatomical criteria are just as important. Any penetrating injury, gunshot, stabbing to the head, neck, or torso automatically qualifies. Major structural damage, like a crushed chest, a fractured pelvis, having two or more breaks in the big long bones like the femur, or an arm or leg that's mangled or has no pulse, those injuries signal massive internal risk.
And sometimes just the way the injury happened is enough, right? The mechanism of injury, the MOI.
What? Absolutely. Even if the patient looks okay right now, certain mechanisms carry such a high likelihood of severe internal injury that they mandate trauma center transport. Things like an adult falling more than 20 feet, or a motorcycle crash over 20 miles per hour, or if someone was ejected from a vehicle, or the passenger compartment where they were sitting was significantly crushed inwards. The physics involved tells us there's likely serious damage, even if it's hidden.
Okay, final points on management. What about deciding between driving someone in an ambulance versus calling a helicopter?
Initial care on scene focuses on those XABCDE priorities, treating shock with oxygen, maybe fluids, keeping them flat if possible, and keeping them warm. The transport decision, ground versus air, usually comes down to distance and time. If the trauma center is far, say over 20, 25 miles, or if road traffic is really bad, air transport can save critical time. Also, sometimes the helicopter crew has more advanced skills or equipment than the initial ground crew, so they might be requested for very critical patients needing interventions beyond what the first responders can provide.
It's good to hear this is all based on evidence, constantly evolving.
Oh, definitely. Modern trauma care is heavily evidence-based. Things we do routinely now, like widespread tourniquet use for limb bleeding or giving tranexamic acid to help stop internal bleeding, those practices were refined based on extensive research. A lot of it learned from military conflicts, sadly, but it translates directly to better civilian care.
So wrapping this up, the big takeaway seems to be the power of understanding kinetics, the mechanism of injury. It lets responders anticipate what's going on inside, even if the outside looks okay. The physics predicts the damage.
Precisely. It demands critical thinking, combining the physics of the event with the patient's response, and then making rapid, prioritized decisions under pressure, especially when multiple things are wrong at once.
That velocity squared factor, kinetic energy, mass 2x velocity, Ranateri, that really sticks with you. And knowing liquids don't compress easily while gases do, it paints a picture of vulnerability inside us. So here's something to think about. Given the physics, which parts of our body are naturally most vulnerable in a high-speed impact, and which might be surprisingly resilient? And maybe more importantly, how could engineers use that detailed knowledge of tissue properties to design even better safety gear for the future?